Welcome back to Office Hours, everyone. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. This is Lesson 12, Disability, Diversity, and Integrating the Foundations. It's the final lesson of the course, and it does two things at once. It surveys disability as a substantive public health topic, and it integrates everything we've covered across the 12 weeks, returning to the question we started with in Lesson 1, what is health, and what does the answer to that question reveal about everything we've talked about?
And the framing the lesson uses is that disability is not just a substantive topic, but a thread through every prior lesson. The integrating function is the course's closing argument.
Right. By the end of this episode, students should be able to articulate what kind of practitioner they want to be as they continue their training and what habits this course has tried to instill in them. So we'll do the substantive work on disability first, then the synthesis.
Let's start with the three models of disability.
How a society conceptualizes disability shapes everything on who is included or excluded, what counts as help, who has authority, what health even means. Three models: medical, social, biopsychosocial, or WHOICF. They're not equally valid in all contexts. Each generates different questions, different interventions, different politics. Understanding all three is essential because real public health work draws on all three, sometimes simultaneously and sometimes in tension.
Medical model first.
Medical model treats disability as an individual problem arising from impairment to be treated, cured, or rehabilitated. Its strengths are clinical. Many conditions associated with disability are clinically meaningful and benefit from medical intervention. A person with controlled epilepsy lives differently from a person with uncontrolled epilepsy. A well-fitted prosthetic limb produces different functional capacity than no prosthetic. The medical model has produced extraordinary benefits for many people with disabilities.
And its limit.
Locates the entirety of the problem in the individual body and treats the social environment as a fixed background. A wheelchair user has a mobility impairment in a building with stairs. In a building with ramps and elevators, they don't. The disability isn't in the wheelchair user. It's in the interaction between the user's body and an environment designed for non-wheelchair users. The medical model can't see the interaction because it treats disability as a property of the individual.
Social model.
Developed primarily by disabled activists and scholars in the UK in the 1970s, particularly Michael Oliver's work, impairment is the biological feature. Disability is what happens when the social environment fails to accommodate impairment. The locus of intervention shifts from the body to the built-in social environment. Most modern disability rights legislation reflects social model thinking. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, the Accessible Canada Act, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
And the curb cut effect.
Ramps cut into sidewalk curbs at intersections, originally implemented for wheelchair users, turn out to benefit parents with strollers, delivery workers with carts, older adults with mobility limitations, and many others. The accommodations designed for disabled people benefit non-disabled people too. The curb cut effect is one of the most generative ideas in inclusive design.
The social model has been critiqued.
Tom Shakespeare and others have argued for a critical realist position that acknowledges both impairment and social construction as real causes of disability. The strong version of the social model, impairment, is irrelevant. Only social barriers matter, underweights the lived reality of chronic pain, fluctuating conditions, and impairment-related limitations that no amount of social change will eliminate. The contemporary mainstream position is roughly that impairment and social environment interact to produce disability, with relative weights varying by condition and context.
And the WHOICF is the synthesis.
International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, adopted in 2001. Disability is the interaction between health conditions, body functions and structures, activities, participation, and environmental and personal factors. The framework is operationally complex, but conceptually coherent. Five levels: body functions and structures, biological features, activities, what the person can do, participation, how the person engages in life situations, environmental factors, physical, social, attitudinal environments, personal factors, individual characteristics. Disability emerges from the interaction of all five.
And the lesson makes the practical point about choosing models.
The three models are not equally valid in all contexts. Different questions call for different frames. Acute clinical care, the medical model is often the right primary frame. Built environment design, the social model is the right frame. Long-term rehabilitation and community integration, the biopsychosocial ICF is usually the right frame. The skill of a practitioner is choosing the right model for the right question. The reflex of an inexperienced practitioner is to apply whichever model they were trained in to every situation. The reflex of an experienced practitioner is to recognize when their default model is inadequate.
Let's move to the disability rights history, which is younger and more recent than most students realize.
Key victories are mostly within the past 50 years. Deinstitutionalization began in the 1960s and continued through the 1990s. Canadian institutions, Huronia Regional Center in Ontario, 1876 to 2009. Tranquil in BC, 1907 to 1985, housed thousands of people with disabilities, often in conditions involving substantial physical and sexual abuse, forced labor, medical experimentation, and substandard care. The Huronia Class Action Settlement in 2013 has begun to document and partially address the wrong.
And the self-advocacy movement grew out of it?
Nothing about us without us. That principle, which now appears in research ethics, policy design, and patient-oriented research broadly, came from disability self-advocacy. People First Canada, founded 1991, has been a primary voice. The Council of Canadians with Disabilities, founded 1976, has been the umbrella organization. The contemporary disability rights movement is a coalition of organizations operating across specific impairment categories and broader civil rights.
The 1977 Section 504 sit-ins are the founding event of modern American disability rights.
April 1977. Approximately 100 disabled activists occupied the San Francisco offices of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to demand that the regulations implementing Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 be signed and enforced 26 days. The longest occupation of a U.S. federal building in history, organized by Judith Heumann, Kitty Cohn, and others, supported by the Black Panthers, Glide Memorial Church, and other organizations that brought food and supplies, the occupation succeeded. On April 28, 1977, Secretary Joseph Califano signed the regulations.
And the pattern.
Disability rights victories require sustained, often confrontational advocacy with substantial coalition building. Section 504 was passed in 1973, but the regulations sat unsigned for 4 years. The sit-ins forced the signature. The recurring pattern is that legislation gets passed when it can be passed cheaply, then sits without enforcement. Pressure from activists, from courts, from journalism is what gets it implemented. The same pattern shows up in the slow implementation of TRC calls to action, inaccessibility legislation in many domains.
The ADA in 1990.
Americans with Disabilities Act, signed by President George H.W. Bush in July 1990. Substantial expansion of U.S. disability rights, prohibits disability discrimination in employment, government services, public accommodations, transportation, and telecommunications, establishes the principle of reasonable accommodation. The ADA has been the model for analogous legislation in many countries.
Canadian Provincial Accessibility Legislation.
Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, passed 2005, established Ontario's accessibility framework. Customer service, employment, information and communications, transportation, built environment. Accessibility for Manitobans Act in 2013, Nova Scotia Accessibility Act in 2017, Accessible British Columbia Act in 2021. Standards are uneven across provinces, and enforcement has been criticized as inadequate in several jurisdictions.
And the federal piece is the Accessible Canada Act.
2019, federal equivalent of provincial legislation. Accessibility requirements for federally regulated entities, federal government, federally regulated transportation, telecommunications, banking. A progressive realization framework with substantive standards developed and phased in over time. Implementation is ongoing through 2026 and beyond. Accessibility Standards Canada was established in 2019 as the standard developing body.
And the UNCRPD as the international piece.
Adopted by the UN General Assembly in December 2006. Entered into force in May 2008. Canada ratified in 2010, the most comprehensive international human rights treaty on disability rights. Principles of accessibility, autonomy, full participation, non-discrimination, equality of opportunity, respect for difference, doesn't directly enforce within Canadian domestic law, but Canadian courts have increasingly referenced it as interpretive guidance.
Let's move to ableism and disability health. The lesson is clear that this is analogous to the racism story in the previous lesson.
Ableism, the social devaluation of disabled people and the privileging of non-disabled bodies and minds, operates analogously to racism, sexism, and other systems of structural disadvantage. Structural manifestations, built environments designed for non-disabled people, education systems that disadvantage disabled students, employment markets that exclude disabled workers, institutional manifestations, healthcare systems with accessibility gaps, legal systems with barriers to disabled litigants, interpersonal, discriminatory attitudes, paternalism, infantilization.
And the empirical evidence.
Disabled people have higher rates of nearly every preventable chronic condition, more unmet healthcare needs, higher rates of mental health concerns, lower self-rated health. Some of the gap reflects the underlying conditions. Much of it reflects barriers to care, occupational and social exclusion, poverty, and ableism in the healthcare system. The disability health gradient is documented in CCHS data and in dedicated disability surveys.
And the analogy to weathering.
Stigmatized identities have measurable physiological effects through chronic stress activation. The cumulative effects on cardiovascular, immune, and metabolic outcomes are increasingly documented for ableism, parallel to what Geronimus has documented for racism. The contemporary disability rights framing treats ableism as a measurable health exposure. The Canadian Disability Inclusion Action Plan, Federal 2022, explicitly recognizes ableism as a contributor to disability health inequities.
Diagnostic overshadowing.
Specific clinical phenomenon. Symptoms in disabled patients are attributed to their pre-existing disability rather than investigated as separate clinical concerns. A patient with intellectual disability presenting with abdominal pain may be assumed to be experiencing behavior problems rather than appendicitis. A patient with cerebral palsy presenting with breathing difficulty may be assumed to be experiencing baseline respiratory issues rather than pneumonia. A patient with severe mental illness presenting with cardiac symptoms may be dismissed as anxious rather than investigated for myocardial infarction, produces measurable delayed diagnoses and documented excess mortality.
Long COVID is the contemporary disability event.
Post-COVID-19 condition affects perhaps 5 to 10% of those infected with SARS-CoV-2. Persistent fatigue, cognitive dysfunction, brain fog, respiratory symptoms, cardiac symptoms, dysautonomia, and a range of other manifestations that often overlap with myalgic encephalomyelitis, or Schock's chronic fatigue syndrome. The scientific characterization is incomplete. Multiple biological mechanisms appear to contribute: persistent viral particles, autoimmune responses, microvascular dysfunction, mitochondrial dysfunction. The disability burden is substantial. A meaningful fraction are unable to work, attend school, or engage in activities of daily living they could before infection.
And it's reopened a lot of older debates.
The boundaries between disease, illness, and disability that we set up in Lesson 1 are being renegotiated in real time. The applicability of existing disability frameworks to long COVID is being worked through. Workers' compensation and disability insurance coverage have been contested. The ME and chronic fatigue syndrome communities, who have been arguing about diagnostic recognition for decades, see long COVID as both a vindication and a familiar pattern of slow institutional response to chronic dispersed illness.
MAID is the most contested contemporary disability rights issue.
Medical assistance in dying, legalized in Canada in 2016 following the 2015 Supreme Court decision in Carter v. Canada. The original framework required a grievous and irremediable medical condition and that the requesting person's natural death be reasonably foreseeable. The 2021 expansion through Bill C-7 removed the reasonably foreseeable requirement, allowing people with grievous and irremediable conditions but no foreseeable death to access MAID. The 2024 further expansion to include mental illness as a sole criterion was paused, with implementation now scheduled for March 2027.
And the disability rights community has been substantially divided, with the dominant position critical of expansion.
The disability rights critique has several components. The remediability question: many conditions classified as irremediable for MAID purposes are conditions where adequate social and material support would substantially reduce suffering. If MAID is offered when adequate support is not, the choice between MAID and continued suffering is not a free choice. Specific cases, multiple Canadian cases since 2021, have documented disabled people seeking MAID due to inadequate housing, inadequate disability supports, or inadequate medical care for treatable conditions. Choices made possible by structural failures rather than the underlying disability.
And the broader argument?
Society should be making it possible for disabled people to live, not making it easier for them to die when supports are absent. Disability rights organizations, including the Council of Canadians with Disabilities, Inclusion Canada, and many others, have advocated against MAID expansion. Catherine Frazee, Canadian disability rights leader and academic, has been particularly prominent. Other disability rights voices have supported MAID access. The 2027 implementation of MAID for mental illness will be one of the most consequential disability rights events of the late 2020s.
Okay, let's transition to the integration piece, the course synthesis.
Yeah, we started in lesson one with the question, what is health? We've come back to it through 12 different lenses. The integrating function is the course's closing argument.
Walk me through what the course has tried to teach.
Substantive content, definitions and models of health, the history of public health institutions and surveillance, the major domains of population health, infectious disease, nutrition and activity, sexual and reproductive health, human development and the life course, genetics, behaviors and mental health, environmental health, occupational health, social and political determinants, disability. The substantive scope is broad by design. We've tried to give exposure to nearly every major domain with enough depth to support informed reading and informed conversation. The depth comes later.
And methodological literacy.
Less formal, but equally important. Students should now be able to read population health claims with attention to four questions. Operationalization. What does this study mean by health? Study type. What kind of evidence is this? Cross-sectional, cohort, RCT, mechanistic, era. When was this done? And what did the field know at the time? And population. Who was studied? And what's the generalizability? The formal methodological work begins in the next courses. This course has prepared students to engage with it more thoughtfully than they could have before.
Historical literacy has been substantial.
Students now know the people and events behind the concepts and the institutions. Grant, Farr, Snow, Chadwick from Lesson 2, Pasteur, Koch, Lister, Semmelweis, Jenner from Lesson 3, Lynn, Goldberger, Keyes, Morris from Lesson 4, Sanger, Dahl, Hill from Lessons 5 and 8, Barker, Felitti, Anda from Lesson 6, Mendel, Watson, Crick, Franklin, Galton, Selikoff from Lesson 7, Marmot, the Black Report authors, Tommy Douglas from Lesson 11, Oliver, Human, Frazee from Today. Reading contemporary literature with this historical context is qualitatively different from reading without it. The names will appear in nearly every paper students read for the rest of their careers.
An ethical literacy which has been direct and uncomfortable when necessary.
Eugenics from Lesson 7, Tuskegee from Lesson 5, residential schools from Lesson 11, Bhopal from Lesson 10, industrial cover-ups across multiple lessons. These are not abstract examples. They're the cases that public health ethics frameworks were built to prevent. And they continue to inform contemporary debates. Long COVID research, MAID expansion, gig worker classification, climate adaptation.
The integrating synthesis.
Health is multidimensional, historically situated, socially produced, and unevenly distributed. That understanding is the soil in which the methodological work of the rest of the program will grow.
Let's talk about what comes next in students' training.
The next course formalizes the concepts students have encountered into measurable variables. Cases, exposures, confounders, populations. It teaches the major study designs, cross-sectional, case control, cohort, ecological, systematic review, and how each can answer different questions. It teaches the formal language of bias, selection, information, confounding. The substantive examples will be familiar from this course. The smoking cancer story, the Whitehall studies, the Framingham Heart study, the Tuskegee case, the ACE study, the Dutch Hunger Winter cohort. The difference is that the next course will teach how to evaluate the studies methodologically, not just what they substantively found.
And the one after that
covers the methods used by the surveillance institutions students met in Lesson 2. Screening test evaluation, sensitivity, specificity, predictive value, outbreak investigation methodology, and the formal machinery of causal inference. Hill's viewpoints, directed acyclic graphs, counterfactual reasoning, the substantive context. What kinds of surveillance Canada actually does, what kinds of outbreaks PHAC and BCCDC actually investigate, what kinds of causal questions matter for policy outcomes from this course.
And the analysis course
teaches students to actually analyze data, regression, model building, handling clustered and repeated measures data, working with real world data sets to produce the kind of evidence the earlier courses taught them to evaluate. The data sets, CCHS, CLSA, provincial administrative data, occupational cohorts, will be familiar by name and substantive content from this course.
And the progression.
Substantive, historical, ethical foundation here, then formal epidemiological methods, then advanced methods, causal inference, surveillance, then applied analysis. This course is the prerequisite that makes the rest of the sequence work as more than a technical exercise. Without the substantive understanding this course builds, the methodological courses produce technically competent practitioners who don't know what they're studying or why it matters. With it, they produce practitioners who can do substantive public health work.
Three habits the course has tried to instill.
If this course has done its job, students leave with three habits. First, operationalization questions. When someone claims an effect on health, you ask which definition, which measure, which population. You distinguish disease, illness, sickness, and health. You distinguish between population level and individual level claims. You ask which study, which cohort, which data set. The operationalization questions are the first move in reading any public health claim carefully.
A second.
Historical questions. Where did this concept come from? What did it replace? Whose interests does it serve? Who is missing from this story? The historical questions reveal that every concept, every institution, every guideline has a particular origin and serves particular purposes. You can be a competent practitioner without asking them. You will be a thoughtful practitioner only if you do.
Third.
Structural questions. Why is this exposure distributed this way? Whose decisions produced that distribution? What structural changes would address the problem at population scale? The structural questions are what distinguish public health from clinical medicine. Without them, public health collapses into a different kind of clinical practice. With them, public health remains the discipline of working at the level of populations and the conditions that produce them.
And the three habits reinforce each other.
Operationalization without historical context produces technically careful but substantively thin work. Historical context without operationalization produces interesting essays but not actionable evidence. Both without structural questions produce excellent technical work that doesn't address why some people get sick and others don't. The combination, operational, historical, structural, is what foundational thinking looks like.
Let's pull this together. Takeaways. First takeaway, the three models of disability, medical, social, biopsychosocial, ICF, generate different research questions, different interventions, and different politics. The skill of a practitioner is choosing the right model for the right question. The reflex of an experienced practitioner is to recognize when their default model is inadequate.
Second takeaway, the disability rights movement is younger than most students realize. Deinstitutionalization, the 1977 Section 504 sit-ins, the ADA in 1990, the AODA and analogous Canadian provincial legislation, the UNCRPD in 2006, the Accessible Canada Act in 2019. The recurring pattern is that legislation gets passed when it can be passed. Substantial enforcement requires sustained advocacy. Structural change is slow.
Third takeaway, ableism is a measurable public health exposure with structural, institutional, and interpersonal mechanisms analogous to racism. Diagnostic overshadowing is a specific clinical phenomenon that produces measurable excess mortality. Long COVID has added a substantial newly disabled population. MAID expansion is one of the most consequential ongoing disability rights debates.
Fourth takeaway. The integrating insight of this course is that health is multidimensional, historically situated, socially produced, and unevenly distributed. The substantive scope of this course, 12 domains across infectious, behavioral, environmental, occupational, social, political, and disability dimensions, supports that synthesis.
Fifth takeaway, the three habits this course has tried to instill are operationalization questions, historical questions, and structural questions. The combination of all three is what foundational thinking looks like, and it makes every later course in the sequence work better.
Sixth takeaway, public health work is often invisible when it succeeds. The clean water, the smallpox eradication, the lead phase out, the seat belts, the smoking decline, the COVID vaccines. These are public health successes that produced extraordinary population health benefits, often without much public recognition. The work matters more than the recognition for it. Choose this field knowing that.
And one more piece of synthesis I want to make. The thread that runs through this whole course is that population health is structurally produced. Individual choices matter. Clinical medicine matters. Behavior matters. But the structural conditions, the air, the water, the housing, the work, the gradient, the colonial legacy, the political choices about who counts, are doing most of the work.
And recognizing that structural production is what distinguishes public health from individualizing frames. It's also what makes the work politically substantive. Public health that takes its own findings seriously eventually arrives at policy frontiers: taxation, labor, immigration, criminal justice, indigenous self-government, accessibility, healthcare design, that are politically charged. That's not a bug, that's the discipline.
I want to add a methodological piece on disability measurement because the lesson treats it carefully and it has implications for everything we'll see in the next courses.
Disability measurement is harder than it looks. The WHO ICF operates at multiple levels with about 1,400 categories grouped into body functions and structures, activities, participation, environmental factors, and personal factors. The methodology requires substantial training to apply consistently. ICF coding has become a recognized rehabilitation specialty in its own right. At population level, the Washington Group on Disability Statistics short set, 6 questions about difficulty with seeing, hearing, walking, remembering, self-care, and communication is the most used instrument. The Canadian Survey on Disability uses an expanded set.
And different instruments produce substantially different prevalence estimates.
Washington Group short set produces about 15% disability prevalence globally, consistent with WHO World Report on Disability Estimates. The CSD produces higher Canadian estimates, about 22% in 2017. Different instruments operationalize disability differently. The methodological best practice is to specify which instrument is being used and to interpret estimates within that operationalization. The contemporary frontier includes activity of daily living measurement and aging research, functional performance tests like the timed up and go and gait speed and grip strength, quality of life measurement instruments like SF36 and EQ5D and WHOQOL, and patient-reported outcome measures developed for specific conditions.
And disability inclusion in research is a substantial methodological frontier.
The NIH designated people with disabilities as a health disparities population in 2023, which was a substantial regulatory shift. NIH-funded research now has to address disability inclusion explicitly. Canadian CIHR-funded research has analogous expectations through the Sex and Gender-Based Analysis Plus framework. The methodological work involves accessibility in research design, consent processes accessible to people with cognitive impairment, communication accommodations, physical accessibility of research sites, disability-inclusive instruments, and community engagement with disability rights organizations. The historical pattern was that disabled people were excluded from research that was supposed to apply to them. The contemporary direction is correcting that.
And the methodological lesson the course as a whole has tried to teach?
Method is not separate from substance. Different methods answer different questions. And the choice of method shapes what a study can find. Reading research with attention to method, what was measured in whom, with what design, with what comparison, is the foundation of substantive engagement with the field. That habit, more than any specific technical skill, is what this course has been trying to instill. The rest of the program builds the methodological capacity. This course has tried to give students the substantive and historical and ethical grounding that makes the methodological work matter.
And one more piece I want to spend a moment on, because it speaks to the integrating function. The lesson's reflection prompt at the end asks students to look back at their lesson one working definition of health and see whether they'd write it differently now.
It's a good prompt. Most students find their lesson one definition feels reasonable, but incomplete in retrospect. They had something biomedical or vaguely social, and they've now seen all the dimensions that any working definition has to accommodate. A useful synthesis at this point is something like, health is a multidimensional, dynamic, socially and historically produced state of being, distributed unevenly across populations by structural factors that shape who is exposed to what, who has access to what, and whose lives are counted. Any definition that fits on a single sentence will leave something out.
And the mark of having learned what the course was trying to teach is not having a perfect definition.
It's having a good ear for what any given definition leaves out, and being able to identify whose interests the definition serves. That capacity to read a definition critically, to ask what's missing, to ask whose framing it is, which is what foundational thinking looks like, it generalizes. You'll use it on study definitions, on policy framings, on news coverage, on professional guidelines for the rest of your career.
I want to close by looking back across the whole course. We've done a lot of ground over these 12 weeks.
We have. We started with definitions and models of health. We worked through the rise of public health institutions and modern surveillance. We did the founding stories of infectious disease, sanitation, hygiene. We took on nutrition, physical activity, and sleep. We worked through sexual and reproductive health with the difficult ethical material around forced sterilization and contemporary access. We did human development across the life course with the ACE framework and the Barker hypothesis. We did genetics and the eugenic legacy. We did the tobacco playbook and how it has been adapted to other behaviors. We did environmental health, including the indoor and built environment and climate, occupational health with the recurring pattern of evidence to regulation delay, social, economic, and political determinants with the Whitehall gradient and the Indigenous health work, and today, disability rights and the integration of the foundations.
And to the students who have stayed with us through all of that, thank you.
Honestly, showing up week after week, working through the readings, doing the activities, struggling through the harder lessons, the material is broad and some of it is genuinely difficult emotionally. You've stuck with it. That matters.
And whatever you do next, whether it's more training in epidemiology and surveillance and analysis, or clinical work that integrates this perspective, or policy work, or community-based practice, or research, or advocacy, or communication, or education, the substantive familiarity and the habits this course has tried to build will travel with you.
Across these roles, the habits, operational, historical, structural, will serve you. So will the substantive familiarity with the major domains and the ethical care the field requires. The course has tried to give you the foundation to choose your specific path with adequate context to choose wisely.
A final thought from the lesson, which I want to read aloud because it captures something the course is genuinely trying to say. Public health work is often invisible when it succeeds. Clean water, smallpox eradication, lead phase out, seat belts, the smoking decline, the COVID vaccines. Public health successes that produced extraordinary population health benefits, often without much public recognition for the people who did the work.
The work is its own reward in the sense that you can know you have contributed to something important. The public credit is rare. Choose this field knowing that the work matters more than the recognition for it. The people you'll meet through the rest of your training, fellow students, professors, mentors, the practitioners you encounter in placements and jobs, are largely people who have made that choice.
Welcome to the field. That's the line the lesson ends on.
Welcome to the field, and thank you again for showing up for this course. It's been a real privilege to walk through this material with you.
All right, let's sign off.
Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, be honest with the data, and remember why the work matters.
See you out there.